Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast desecrated, functilated, demonicated, prevaricated, postulated to creating a living social history book about street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world.
Matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plants well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Nor the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
Nobody's really discovering a new place to work. Everybody's fighting for a big show in one spot, but they don't have to fight for a big show in one spot. There's shows everywhere to be had.
When I first met Rob Torres at the Windsor Busker Fest many moons ago, I was struck by the impression that he knew a secret that I hadn't figured out yet. There seemed to be something lingering just beyond the current topic of conversation that suggested a knowledge that I wanted to tap into. I recognized this again when I watched him perform. As I edited this week's episode and learned about his background and listened to how he approaches things, some of the pieces started to fall into place, but there's still a lot that's mysterious about this little bald clown, as I'm sure you'll hear, along with so many stories from the pitch. And now, here's Robert.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage one of the most amazing acts I've ever seen. He's got talent, he's got looks. Please welcome a man who has none
of
these.
Oh, wait, he's not here.
Oh, right, he's not here. Instead, please welcome Rob Torres.
God, how you doing, Baldy?
Long time, Baldy.
Gosh, it has been a long time, hasn't it? You don't look much different. You do have a bit more hair on your head than I expected.
I've just started vacation. I've been working, and it's time to have a break.
You've had tremendous luck in not only busking circles, clown circles, whatever it is. I've watched you work with Hokum. I've watched you walk into situations and get total autonomy. Because of some, I don't know what you have with administrative people, but you somehow slither in there and under the wire figure out exactly what you want and get them to give it to you. You're a sneaky one, Rob Torres.
I really don't know how it happened, honestly, that way.
Well, you've had a bit of luck over the years. That's all I can say.
Yeah. For sure. I've had more than my share of luck.
Yeah, you have.
Including the L.A. County Fair. Man, I got to perform live on stage with this famous freaking street performer.
You remember that show?
Yeah, I do actually remember that show. It was a hell of a day. You got to understand, I'm sitting there filling in for the chainsaw juggler.
You were tired from the start. You weren't looking forward to it, huffing and puffing. There was a really great moment where you were about to shove fire in my mouth and you didn't know if I could fire eat. And you were being butterfly, but at one moment you turned and you had this great look in your eyes, like you really cared whether or not I could eat fire.
You can kill somebody very easily if they don't know what they're doing with fire eating. If they breathe in, they asphyxiate, their lungs collapse. And I didn't particularly want to kill a clown in front of the audience. I don't know.
I appreciated that.
Was it your life I cared about as much as I didn't want to go to jail? Yeah, you could have died right then if I could have gotten away with it. I love you, Baldy. I do. Let's talk about Rob Torres, how he started, what he saw at the beginning, what inspired you to get into this busking thing. It had to be your start, right?
No, busking was third.
Really?
Yeah. I did theater first and did stuff with Sesame Street. And then I went and did the circus for 3 years on tour.
Would that be the Big Apple?
No, it was Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I did a tent show for 3 years. We toured around and did like In the Mud every day, changing around. It was so much fun.
Wow.
It was boot camp for clowning. If you want to learn something, try it there. If it works, it works.
Did you have clown training?
Well, I went to clown college.
But that was Ringling.
Ringling's clown college. For me, it was a 3-month taste of the style of Ringling clown, the style that they choose that they need for their show, and it's a training ground for them. Along the way, there's a couple of interesting classes that, like, here's a little bit extra. Right. It was a big circus school for 3 months, so I learned a bit of wire walking, stilt walking, trapeze, things like that.
Okay, you get your tent experience, you get a little bit of theater training as a young man. I'm guessing in the early 80s, you make your foray into the world?
Yeah. It was 82, 83, somewhere in there.
Who was your first busker? What did you see? I guess New York?
The first busker that I saw. No, it was in Key West. Hmm. I didn't know the busking scene in New York so much at that time. I was doing other things.
Right.
So I think my first was in Key West.
I'm assuming it's Mallory Square.
It was Mallory, yeah, before they redesigned it. It was 93.
Whoa, that's pretty late.
Oh, totally. What I just came into and what I know from meeting people and watching stuff now is it was the end of an era, a beautiful era too.
Who was it that did it for you?
I think it was the overall experience. I don't think any one of them actually did it for me. It was them. It was their character. Maybe it's a joke that had been done before, but they were married to it in such a way that it was natural.
Right.
I think circus was the first magic to me of a place, like an empty space that can build this world in one day, come in and make this big show and take off. And when you look 2 days later, it's gone. If you didn't catch it, you missed out.
So you saw the magic there. And something about that atmosphere said to Rob Torres, I can do this. I can make it happen in my own way. Because you definitely were original in your approach to it.
I don't think I had the same perspective. I didn't come into it the same way.
Right.
I looked at the street and I found it a great place to workshop and play.
Right.
Like there were some really radical and wild things that happened on the street. And then people, I think, were becoming more PC and more cautious, you know, as the 90s grew. So it was still a great place to experiment with stuff. Because if you could just grab a crowd and do an act, why not? It's the quickest place to learn and make acts.
It might have been PC, but you are not PC. You pretend Absolutely. That you are.
I have a routine for crying babies with Winnie the Pooh. It starts out, I make a baby cry. Like I intentionally make noises that'll make a baby cry. But nobody really knows that I'm doing that. And so when that happens, here's this chaos. And I make a balloon because everybody thinks, oh, he's so sweet, he's making a balloon. And I pop it in the baby's face so the baby cries more. And then I grab a teddy bear and its head falls off. By this point, if the baby is not crying but the face is looking like I'm panicked, it's really a funny situation.
It's so wrong, but
it's totally wrong.
It's just wonderful. The first time I saw you perform, I said, you know, I've seen this crap before. And then you just drew me in and twisted it and then punched me right in the face with your, I don't know, it was so subtle. I'd never seen anybody subtly suggest that they were such an evil person underneath this clown persona. It was wonderful.
Well, good. I mean, it's, I don't know, it's me.
It's definitely you.
I'm the evil person underneath my fine, happy interior and exterior.
Oh, you're a torture.
Everybody has a dark side.
Come you're on. A tortured individual, my friend. You're tortured. Let me ask you, where was your first show?
My first street show.
Yeah.
It was in, 2001, 2002. I was in Central Park just trying a whole bunch of stuff to see what would work to gather a crowd because I didn't understand that yet. Mm. And yeah, it was really ridiculous. It was fun. Like I would figure stuff out and people would just walk by and go, nah, we're not going to stop this. We're not going to look at this. When I started getting really interested in working, I found really cute places to make shows in the park. There was a time when the cops started coming into Central Park and stopping people from doing shows. So I could do a show on a bunch of benches with an amplifier built into a suitcase with a remote on it. Mm. And when I saw a cop coming over the hill, turn the music off and read a paper, and everyone was in on the joke. Everyone got it. Uh-huh. And we all played this game, and it was such a fun, like we were all kids. It wasn't a show. It stopped. But we didn't stop. Like we all stayed there, being naughty. And it was that kind of stuff that I found fun to play with in different places, and that became a show. It had a completion, and I found it really interesting to find different places to work and different things from different places, not normal places where you could pound out shows.
I loved to play behind Central Park Zoo. Everybody was fighting for the big pitch at the fountain, lining up. If you got a show, you got a show in. Everybody worked well together at that time, but you couldn't work a lot. And I could go over and make park bench theater for 50 people. And I could do a 40-minute show, and people would pay really well because it felt like a little theater show.
Gosh.
And I'd rather have 40 people who pay 10 bucks a piece than 200 people who pay a dollar a piece.
I can't do the math real quick, but I'd agree with you. After your stint in Central Park, where did you go? What did you do?
After Central Park, I went down to Orlando for a little bit. I worked Church Street Station. And then I worked at Disney for a little while, just kind of figuring out, gathering a crowd and building a structure to a show.
So they actually hired you at Disney World?
Yeah, I fooled them.
That's like joining the army, I hear.
Oh, it's boot camp. But, you know, in 2 months of doing it, you learn how to do a show.
Absolutely. Because you're putting it out there every day, all day.
You have to. It's not a lazy kind of, should I go work today or not? Because you can do the same on the street. But because of the nature of having a contract, I had to do five shows a day.
Right.
And they're 20-minute shows, and it didn't matter if they failed. They didn't care about that. Jeez. Gather a crowd, and that's good enough. So it was a trial period, and in the trial period, I figured out how to make a show work.
What did you do after Disney?
After Disney, I went up to Kingston. Kingston was my first festival in Canada because I had booked Halifax and wanted to understand the Canadian crowd and also kind of what works for Hatting, because I had heard Halifax was a big festival. And I thought, well, maybe it'd be good to try a festival for a few days and understand before I get there so that I don't waste a few days at a good festival. It was the summer of 2002 when I did Kingston and Halifax.
Who'd you run into in Kingston, and what did you see in Halifax?
Kingston was an interesting year that year. It was the very first street performing festival I had gone to, but somehow the lineup that year, Carl Salader was up there. That's how I met you.
Mm.
And Phil and Colin from the Silly People were up there.
Yep.
And Jeff...
Collins?
Collins, thank you. He was there. And this little kid, Cody... You remember Cody? He was a little blonde-haired boy.
God, I remember that kid. I saw that kid.
Yeah. He rode a unicycle, and I thought, you're a really cute kid, and you have a really cute act, and in about 5 years, you need to learn how to perform.
Yeah, he was a fetus when I first met him.
Yeah. But he was out there. I was like, bless him.
Give me some information about this that prepared you for Halifax, the big boy.
So the festival, on Saturday night, on the street, ran shows really circle to circle up King Street, and it was about 6 or 7 shows running. And it was because that right lineup of performers happened to be there. People respected each other. They knew that there was enough people on the street to make shows, and here's what it took to make a show in that space without really disrupting the other show.
So you're saying that you learned how to work with a whole bunch of acts in one space and that...
In a very small space.
Right.
Because to do a show back to back and not disrupt the other show and what's going on, unless you decide to play together.
Right.
Or it kind of happens naturally, but like not to have battles with music and other shit, just to make it work. Because it can, because that's what people go out for.
Did you see the same thing happening up in Halifax when you got there?
It was a program in a different way, and it was spread out differently in space, so it wasn't the same kind of environment.
Right, it was the whole waterfront area, and you gave specific times, day and night, to perform.
Yeah, it was 3 shows a day, I think, and 10 days in different pitches.
Halifax changed over the years. You know, when I first started, it was a 17-day festival. And
okay.
By the time you got into it, I was already blacklisted.
What'd you get blacklisted for?
I didn't particularly like the way beer was being sold by the powers that be to the buskers for a dollar can. When I knew, because I had talked to the head of the beer company, Labatt,
yeah,
that they had donated the beer to the buskers. So I felt it was inappropriate to charge the buskers for something that you got for free anyway.
And that was the intention. It was a gift for the buskers.
Yes, I felt it was, but apparently the administration didn't. So Andrew Elliott and I went down to a local beer mart, and I bought, I don't know, I think it was something like 10 cases of really good beer.
and we hustled it back to the dormitory that we were living in, and I borrowed an amount of refrigerators to get it all cold. And I went up and I would stand in front of the green room, a very small green room where they supplied the beer. And before anybody went in to get a beer, I'd go, "Hey, you want a beer?" And I'd say, "Here." And I'd give them one, you know, a nice cold frosty ale. Of course, nobody was buying the beer. But my greatest moment was when a guy named Hendrickson, who ran the sound, walked up. And the lady who was running the festival, Kim, had a thing for him at that particular time. She was still Kim Kelly. She became Kim Hendrickson later. Mind you, while I'm handing out these beers, I'm drinking. So I'm pretty plastered by this time. I do see the look of shock and awe on her face. This guy walks up and I saw the glimmer of recognition in his eye. And I said, "Oh, I'm very pleased to meet you. You want a beer?" And handing him the beer in front of her, it was just so cathartic. You know, I'm dying inside with laughter. I'm just dying. And it was just a moment that I'll treasure and take with me to my grave.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and I might have crossed the line.
So what?
Yeah. It didn't matter to me.
What a good game.
Yeah. Tell me about your experience in Halifax.
Halifax was fun. Like, it was kind of just a bigger, wilder, chaotic festival for me because it was a larger lineup. So I just wanted to see shows and kind of see how they put together the festival.
Right.
And then do shows. So in the end, there wasn't, I don't know, it went by in a blur. It was very corporate. I don't know. Like, I didn't like it. I put clauses in contracts about corporate work. So to do corporate extras, I didn't have to deal with it.
Oh, but nice.
But corporate stages I found a bit appalling.
Right.
You know, like, great, you have sponsors, but I didn't agree to be in front of the Pepsi stage with a backdrop like that. Put a sign on the corner. This is the Pepsi stage.
Right.
That's good enough. Pepsi's our sponsor. Thank you.
So I've pretty much got in my head you starting out in New York, Central Park, going down to Mallory, checking it all out, heading up to Kingston to prepare yourself for Halifax, going into Halifax, and then what, did it just explode for you on the international scene with the festival circuit, or what?
You know what I think it was? I think it was Kingston more than Halifax, man.
Mm.
Because I made friends with Phil and Colin, the silly people, and Phil invited me to perform at his wedding.
Really?
That's where Carl and I became friends.
You were talking about Taxi Trick.
Taxi Tricks.
Right.
So he had like all these performers who came to the wedding and they all wanted to perform. And Phil said, "I have a surprise for you." So I had not met any of these people yet. And I performed there. So I got to know some of the performers on the circuit then. But because Phil and I met and became friends and did the wedding, he invited me up to do a variety show in November. He'd fill the house for a variety show, but he'd never make money. And it was a basic weekend. Just come up and hang out. It's a good time. And I've worked with a few people like this along the way, and I say, why not? Why not do that? You know, because it's a good time. It's fun.
So you must have developed some strong relationship with Taxi, with Carl. But I was initially attracted to this guy from his writing.
To Carl.
Yeah, I thought he was one of the most amazing, prolific writers of poetry. Gosh, I remember something happening about pigs. He wrote over 100 different poems, sometimes more than one or two a day, about pigs. Everything had a flying pig in it in different scenarios. I saw it on PNET, you know, Jim of the Jim Show's site.
Yeah,
That's where we all got together in the early days before Facebook. And Carl Salater, Taxi Trick's name, came up so many times. I made a point that if I was going to be in the area, I'm going to go up and see this guy. And I guess you were the guy that took me up there.
Carl was another creative soul. That's what I found when I met Carl. Like, I've connected with creative souls along the way.
Mm.
And he has the show that he does, but he's a creative soul.
Right.
He sculpts. He writes poems.
Right.
He'll paint a little bit. He'll try this.
He doesn't have to be great at it, but he's creative. He generates something.
Most definitely. And he seemed to have just a gregarious type of feeling about himself. He worked really well with people.
He was just full of love. He always is. Carl is just full of love.
And he became a hub. That church became a hub for a performance.
Totally.
Yeah.
What a great place to meet. Because it brought New England, the northern New England, Bostonians and people up in that sector, Jim, down, and people from New York up.
Right.
And it was a great place to connect for those two crossovers.
No question about it. The times I spent at his place in his dusty old basement with all those books around me.
Oh, yeah.
And filthy laundry, I might add, and a shower that was just disgusting. But I did enjoy myself immensely.
You took showers there?
I did.
I just stank.
Well, I was the only one. So you must have started going international somewhere in the mid-2000s?
I think what happened, I did this wedding with Phil, and then he invited me up for the variety show, which happened as Confab happened in Canada.
Mm.
So Shelley saw me for the first time. Al Kreiser saw me for the first time.
Okay,
the people from Waterloo saw me for the first time, whoever happened to be in charge that year. And so people just saw that 15-minute spot I did in their variety show and said, we want you for our festival.
Gotcha.
And that allowed Canada to happen, and I got to meet people along the way. I had gone to Singapore before with the people from Halifax.
Right. What was that guy's name? Jimmy Wong, right?
Jimmy Wong, yeah.
Right.
Jimmy Wong booked it. And the first character I did there was a guy named Mr. Brown. It was a totally different character than what I was doing, but some tricks and some of the same material. Like, I kind of knew what the show would be, but I didn't find the character yet.
So you're telling me that what I saw, you didn't do down there, or?
No, not for the Busker Festival.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I did a different character for the Busker Festival. It was a bit of a heavyset guy with a mustache and big glasses.
Really?
And a shopping trolley.
Well, you've got more in your little bag of tricks than I thought. I thought you pretty much had that one thing that you did, because you do it so well.
No, man, I'm a creative soul. I like other things, but I do that because it's commercial, and it really does work in a lot of settings, and I built it for that.
Yes.
So that it would generate money for me to do other things, because some things don't generate money.
So it's primarily a theater performance, though, isn't it?
Well, I started working to build acts specifically for variety shows and for circus. And as I started doing that, I thought some of these things would really tie well together to make a really nice clown theater show and to tour it. And building a clown theater show, I needed a theater.
Right.
I ended up on cruise ships for 4 years touring the world.
Well, that was when you were dating the Rockette, right?
That was after I was dating the Rockette. Like, we split up and I went to Brazil, which is a really good place for a breakup.
Whew, you're telling me.
Oh, man, it was great. And I really liked the people. I really liked their energy and their style, and it was fun.
Right.
I had framed out a show in my mind that I wanted to do in a theater. I put it on the street in a basic way with no technical capabilities, just to block things like I would in a workshop with an audience.
So you jumped off the ship and just did some street?
The contract started this way. Like, I booked a contract. They booked me for a ship to tour around Brazil for 3 months. And I did a good show the first week, and they got reports, and they decided they wanted to put me on a second ship. So they'd fly me off the ship and put me in some place for 3 nights. So if I'm there for 3 nights every couple of days, why not?
Absolutely.
You know, like, get to know the people and have fun.
Well, no question about it. Interestingly enough, the mayor's son of Rio was a big street busker fan.
Okay.
Yeah, he tried to do a little fire eating and stuff like that. And he had a few of us come down there under contract to work. Nothing ever really worked out because he was a dunderhead. But his love of busking and the Brazilian people themselves, it's just an outstandingly beautiful part of the world. Unquestionably, the women, I guess they're the most beautiful on the planet. There's... I don't know.
For me, too, that there's something simple. That they have a sex appeal inside of them.
Right.
that other Latino women don't have the same way, though Latinos, I think, have the most sex appeal. I don't know. Asians do, too.
Yeah, Asians
are mysterious that way. Come on.
I mean, they really are, man. Yeah, I don't know if this podcast is supposed to go in that direction.
I don't know.
It's all about busking.
Really, no. Okay, Anglo-Saxons are not sexy. But besides the Anglo-Saxons.
Okay, so you did some international touring with cruise ships, and you got to experience different cultures along the way. How long did that last?
I don't know, because it was mixed with all sorts of other stuff. I did festivals along the way and other gigs that I wouldn't normally do. Because I had a solid place to generate the income from.
Right.
To really take the dive into trying stuff and having fun.
I don't remember the exact year that I saw you perform, but it seemed like such a powerful show that you had to have had that thing worked out. It was so polished that you could jump in and out of it, you know?
I saw you perform with Hokum one time. And I was just saying, gosh, you know, what a wonderful compliment you two were to each other, you know?
Oh, that was a great discovery.
It's just kind of shocking, isn't it, sometimes to find out that you can work with somebody else?
I think people can really, like, if they're really open, people of all different styles can work with each other without problems. Mm-hmm. And he and I just blended well together. There was no ego in it. It was just, let's go play and have fun. It was definitely a nice compliment from the beginning. And we made a really magical show in Edmonton the year that they went away from the downtown square.
Right.
Because they were rebuilding Sir Winston Churchill.
Right.
And we went over to the Fringe grounds.
Right. That's actually where I saw you.
Ah, okay. So maybe you saw the magic show.
Do you ever remember an audience member stand out?
Be magical?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had a few. A couple of kids and an old man once. I was working on a cruise ship a few years ago, and I asked this old guy to take a picture of me, and I gave him the camera, and he said no. So I started this little kind of faux argument with him in gibberish, and he just said no. And it was a great little moment of tension, and he picked up his cane and put it in my chest like a sword. So he initiated a story, and I loved it. I went, oh, okay, and I walked off stage and came back on with a broom and unscrewed the end of the broom, and we got in a sword fight. And he stood up and he sword fought with me. In the end, he killed me and I died on stage. When he sat down, he had this look of amazement in his eyes because he was standing without his cane. And it kind of brought back that reality of the power of playing. That was, for an older person stand up, that was a pretty magical moment.
Yeah, I find it interesting myself that age has nothing to do with a person just being able to grab the magic. Sure, it's cute to look at a kid do something out there, but old people, I think maybe the walls go down a little bit sometimes when you get into a one-on-one with them. I remember this one gentleman, he said something to me, and I just berated him mercilessly because of his age. And I just kept going on and on throughout the performance, talking about how this might be the last thing he ever sees. And, you know, it got a little bit, I mean, maybe it wasn't all that distasteful, but I harped on it over and over again, right? Because I didn't really know where else to go. But he stayed with there. And the energy I was getting from him was good. But the really good part where he nailed me, I mean, he just nailed me. I do that little rose balance on the end, you know, where I balance the rose on my nose and I say the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And right as I finish, just before I can even go, I'm the butterfly man, I thank you for your kind attention, he whips out what looked like the biggest handkerchief I've ever seen in my life, and he starts dabbing his eyes mockingly, going, oh, that was so beautiful. You know, I didn't know what to say. I just looked at that guy. Oh, God, you got me in here. I'm supposed to turn this in the hat. And you, you know, he got me good. He got me really good.
What a great play.
Yeah, that's the whole thing about not having a script you have to follow, but leaving that openness in your audience to play with you. How about losing it during a show?
I was in Belgium once. I was invited over for this International Street Performers Festival, which turned out to be a street fair that this guy wanted performers at. So it was a really weird gig. And the whole weekend, there were a bunch of us fighting to at least get a show off.
Right.
And I got one group of people together. They stopped. They were watching. Everything was going right. But there was no response. Absolutely nothing. No reaction at all. And that's really weird. It was as if I wasn't there or they were watching television. And I did this one trick. I tie a necktie with one hand.
Yeah.
And there was no reaction on that. And that's generally one that at least people give a little surprised look at. So I just stopped and said, really? Do you see that every day? You people don't react to anything. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Wow.
And went on this little tirade for a minute, and they started laughing at it. And it was a really bizarre little moment. And I ended up back doing a little bit of show and finished and had it. And this guy came up to me later and said, we liked the show, but we didn't understand the point where we became the antagonist.
Right.
We missed the connection in the transition of, and they really took it way too seriously.
Always, it's an audience member is going to come up to you. You know, I really liked that part of the show, but why did you have to kill that kid? Well, you know, it just happened. It's not normally a part of the show, lady. It's amazing that people actually believe that you have planned.
Oh, yeah. Some conviction to it. The show is a show.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, I've got to some dark moments in shows that I really wanted to. I really wanted to one time get the audience to turn on me so much that I went and hung myself and really end the piece in this dark, morbid moment. Let them think about it. And I don't know why it inspired me, but it was such a lovely end. There was booing, there was hissing, and then there was silence.
Well, they don't boo if they like you. You get that silence, that nothing. That zero, zilch, when they really don't like you.
That particular piece, I went out, got them to like me, then turned. I started doing stuff that they started really not liking. To the point where they were heckling me. And I let it really affect me. And then I just went and I climbed up a ladder and hung myself into a blackout. All the way to booing and heckling and, yeah, go ahead, do it. To silence.
Ooh. Oh, that's effective.
It was a really, really cool moment.
I like that.
I wanted to do it in Key West. I wanted to do a piece on the death of street performing.
Ooh.
And do a public hanging. Climb a ladder on the new archway in Mallory Square and do a big speech about art and performance and censorship and killing it by this and that and then just jump and hang myself.
Yeah, it sounds like you get some strong feelings in that area.
Oh, yeah.
What do you feel about the art form? Do you think it's really dying?
No, I think cities are killing it. I think to a certain extent, performers are, just by the nature of continuing to make pitches work, just in a survival sense, without the consciousness of generating and educating an audience to come back and build that place. And it becomes a fight, at least in certain spaces in the world. It becomes just a fight. And now it's one bigger than the next. If they have really good character and the show is really good and the quality is really good, okay. But if it's not, then it's, I don't know, there's something being lost.
I've heard this a lot from a lot of individuals, that pitches are a little bit more competitive, and they're competitive for economic reasons more than anything else. And they get overcrowded and this, that, and the other. But aren't new places opening up?
One of the best shows I ever saw worked on the subway. I think it was the Q between Queensboro Plaza and 59th Street, which is a 5-minute ride without stops. And this guy came out in the afternoon with an old baby carriage. And the subway was just full enough of people that everybody was sitting down.
Mm.
And when the doors closed, he pulled out a dove pan and a metal rod. And he just went clang, 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 clang. About 10 seconds. And it was just long enough to piss people off. And people looked up with that face like, what the fuck are you doing? And in that second, he covered that lid and pulled out a dove. And people just went, huh? And for the next 3 minutes, all he did was make things appear and disappear without ever looking at anyone. And his finale, he produced a cloth and he changed it and it said, thank you. And then he looked up at the audience as he looked at the cloth, and he just caught the eyes of the people who were watching him. And it changed to tips, please. And he must have made, I don't know, 50, 60 bucks on one ride.
Wow.
I talked with him for a while, and that was his pitch. He knew his 3 hours in the afternoon. He could come in, he could go home. He'd get over a grand doing that. And he was a little worker. He had a great little show. And he made it for that place. And he taught me about working space. And I put together a little finger puppet show to go and play at the Metropolitan Opera House at intermission for the smokers and do a mini version of the opera they were singing. And in 10 minutes, I could make a complete show. And that's a pitch that nobody works because nobody created a show for there. Everybody's
right.
Fighting for a big show in one spot, but they don't have to fight for a big show in one spot. There's shows everywhere to be had.
It was great talking to you, Rob.
It's great talking to you, too.
Yeah, you need to close it out by saying something beautiful and wonderful and memorable.
In all of the years of street performing, I have seen some really, really fantastic performers. Some people who not only have the talent and the skill to entertain a crowd, but the passion for the art, the kindness behind it, the spirit to continue that on. And I met you, and I'd heard about you, and the greatness that a street performer can have, you really don't possess any of it. Why? After all these years, I was a big tour of you.
I'll talk to you later. Talk to you soon, Baldy.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
Aloha.
All right, Bald. Good one.
Stories from the Pitch is produced by the Busker Hall of Fame. Music for today's podcast came off of Hokum W. Jeebs' Piano a la Carte CD. Special thanks to the estate of Hokum W. Jeebs for allowing us to use his music and keep his memory alive. Subscribe to this podcast by iTunes. Just go into the Music Store's podcast section and search for Stories from the Pitch. And while you're there, take a second to post a review. These reviews help with our ranking and visibility in iTunes. If you have music tracks you'd like us to feature, are a helpful web genius, or heck, just an opinionated old busker with a salty mouth, we want to hear from you. Drop me a line at cbg@buskerhalloffame.com. We also have loads of additional content each week on our Facebook page at facebook.com/buskerhalloffame. In this week's episode, one of the reoccurring themes was that there are shows everywhere to be had, but I don't think this is exactly what Rob meant.
Hey, really quickly, can I take a pause? I'll call you back. I gotta run to the toilet. Be back in a bit.
Oh, that was so beautiful!
On behalf of the staff of Busker Hall of Fame, we hope you have a great week, and as you perform for audiences around the world, please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm David Aiken, the Checkerboard Guy. Thanks for listening.
What a great play!